Support for WPR comes from the Stevens Point area, offering a variety of getaway experiences, itineraries and ideas for beer lovers, foodies, outdoor recreation fans, and more are at StevensPointArea.com.
Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
Welcome back to The Grindstone. Hope you had a good Labor Day weekend and enjoyed some time off the job, but the party's over. It's time to head back to the salt mines. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, September the 6th. And during this edition of On Your Money, financial planner Kevin McKinley tells us how we can avoid the things about our jobs that could be making us sick, or at least posing some health risks. And if you are sick and tired of your job, how can you figure out the costs of staying versus going? Plus answers to your personal finance questions, as always. 1-800-642-1234. Give us a buzz, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, and an all-around hard worker. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Joy.
Did you have a good holiday weekend?
Yes. As appropriate for Labor Day, I labored. I caught up on some work at the office, but also found some time to hang around with my family a little bit, and it was enough for them. They said, okay, Dad, you can go back to work now. We got our quality time in.
I'm glad that everybody's happy. Last week, we were talking about some job numbers, some big-picture job numbers, and some of them quite surprising. Today, you have some information about ways our jobs can have a negative effect on our health and what we can do about it. So our jobs can be making us sick?
Yes, and when we do talk about health and job-related injuries, I'm sure that my dear departed grandfather, who ran away from home in the eighth grade to go work in the logging mills of northern Minnesota and saw people die on the job and saw trees fall all the time and was battered and bruised by the work he did for 50 years. I'm sure he is rolling in his grave right now while we're complaining about, you know, carpal tunnel syndrome from moving your mouse a little bit incorrectly. However, many people are working in part for health insurance, and the jobs are definitely easier right now, at least in terms of physical labor. In part, workplace injuries are way down because of safety regulations, because of technology versus the amount of manual labor required to complete tasks, and because there's less manufacturing as a percentage of our workforce. But there are some common afflictions for people who do work on more brain power jobs, and there are also some cures for them as well.
Well, so where do you want to start?
Well, let's start with how most people start their day, and what they're doing right now is they're listening to this show. With a daily commute, it can offer physical stress, emotional stress, isolation. A University of Zurich study said that most workers, if they were required to commute for an extra hour during the day, they would need a 40% increase in their salary because they dread it so much. The average length of commuters in the United States is about 26 minutes each way each day. It's hard on men, it's harder on women, and it's harder even more so for couples. University of Sweden study found a few years ago that couples who have at least one partner who commutes more than 45 minutes each way to work are more than twice as likely to split up than couples who don't have that type of commute. And it really does boil down to time versus money, because in terms of health anyway, if you're sitting in your car, or even if you're sitting on a bus or a train or whatever, that's time you can't be exercising. It's difficult to get a healthy meal on the table or in the morning or at night. Now, a fix for this is obviously to leave earlier if you can, to move closer to your job if you can, and to use public transportation so that at least you don't have to be behind the wheel. But a lot of people don't have that option. So if you are driving and you're just sick of this commute, you might want to give yourself something to look forward to during the trip, along with listening to Wisconsin Public Radio, of course. If you have a, you know, buy yourself an iPod, get books on tape or a podcast or something that really kind of offers you a little treat and say, every time when I get in the car, oh, good, I get to do this for it. And this is something I've advised a lot of people to have more money than time to do all the things they want to accomplish. There's nothing noble in doing all of this yourself and then losing sleep or losing contact with your family members for it. Hire somebody else to do some of these odd jobs that need to be done, whether it's grocery shopping, picking up the laundry. A lot of people are looking for this type of work, and it's easier to find than it ever has been before. So please think about doing it if it frees up more time for you to do what you want.
Sounds good. You know, I do consider myself really fortunate. I have only maybe a 10-minute commute to work each morning, but I do have to do it at oh dark 30.
And well, part of that, too, is the Wisconsin Public Radio helicopter lands in your backyard.
Yes, that's right.
Picks you up and ferries you up to the roof of the building owned by us there. And
yeah, there's no traffic at oh dark 30, but it does mean that I have to get up really early, which maybe can do some other things to my health. But what else about our jobs can have negative effects on our health?
Well, the other nice thing about your job and your health, Joy, is that you generally get to go to the same place every single day. People who have to travel for the job, especially have to do it on a day-to-day basis, have much higher incidences of health problems than people who sit behind a desk. The Wall Street Journal cited a study recently from Columbia University that said workers who have to travel, who are on the road for 21 days or more per month, are 92% more likely to suffer obesity than those who might only travel a couple days or so every single month. They're also more likely to suffer higher blood pressure and higher stress, and they have worse sleep patterns because they're staying in a hotel almost every single night. Well, the fix for that is to try to eat early and late, not during the day because you're trying to grab stuff on the go and it's hard to eat healthier, and try to eat very light. Skip the after hours things for people who have to travel and you know, go out to dinner with potential clients or colleagues or whatever at a convention. Skip that and go work out. And finally, develop a sleep routine so that when you're going someplace that's unfamiliar, that you have something there that's the same pattern, same way of going to sleep every single night. And hopefully you'll sleep a little better, which should help your health as well.
So sitting on my duff for 3 hours in this studio is a healthier job?
You would think, but I have bad news for you. A couple of studies, one from Australia that said 10 years of sitting at a desk for more than 6 hours a day can double a person's risk of colon and colorectal cancer.
Great.
The American Cancer Society said that women who sit more than 6 hours per day are 37% more likely to suffer premature death, and men who do the same are 18% more likely to suffer premature death than those who are getting up and walking around. And plus, like we mentioned, you can get a physical strain from your neck and your hands and your shoulders from using a computer. So a fix is to rearrange your desktop, of course. And this is one of the largest growing movements in workplace ergonomics, is to have a stand-up desk. And Facebook is actually a company that is leading the way in providing its employees stand-up desks so that they aren't sitting all day and they're moving around. They're finding that the employees are actually more productive, they are losing weight, and they are in better health. And there is even a Trek makes a desk that fits over a Trek treadmill for about $500 that allows you to walk a mile an hour or so while you ostensibly do your work.
I like that. I could see it standing up here in the studio, too. I interviewed someone who wrote a book called Move a Little, Lose a Lot, and I tried to do the interview standing up, and it works. It's just a little far to reach for some of the buttons. We just had to make a few changes in here.
It is, and then also, of course, depending on how much you work and how much you move, you might annoy your coworkers a little bit, which could lead to some other health problems
like
for you.
Like what?
Well, there's a study out just recently that from the University of Tel Aviv that found that the key to employee happiness and health is not money. It is not how their bosses treat them. It's how much support they have from their coworkers. And so people who get along better with the people at work and offer support and receive it back in return generally are happier and more productive than those who don't. But there is a downside to that. A study that was presented at the Academy of Management a few days ago found that disagreeable people make quite a bit more money than people who are nice. Men make on average about 18% more, and women make about 5% more than the nice guys. So understand, you're going to get along better at work, you're going to have better health, but you might make a little less money.
Sometimes it's not fair, Kevin.
It isn't.
Kevin McKinley, certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC, here to answer your questions on your money. 1-800-642-1234 if you have a question about your personal finances that you'd like to run by Kevin. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley, and this is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's time now for the On Your Money email bag. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. You should consult with your financial advisor prior to making any investment decisions. Kevin, a listener who wishes to remain anonymous has a son and a daughter-in-law who are under some pressure from the in-laws to buy the parents' home. This listener thinks that the price and terms are unfavorable to and unaffordable for this young couple, and wonders what can and should be done about this.
Well, this question falls, Joy, as you probably recognize, into a fast-growing category of questions at On Your Money about personal financial relations, which involves more the personal than the financial, where spouses or parents of children send in questions here, and if they get the answer they want, they report back to the other side saying, "See, I told you so." And then, of course, if they don't get the answer they want, they say they just ignore it.
They
don't even bring it up whatsoever.
It.
An error of omission, if you will.
So, what should this parent worried about her or his son and daughter-in-law?
Well, there's a couple of factors here, of course. It's the couple's situation and the questioner deciding when to butt in and when to stay out. So I would say if the young couple says, no, we really want this, we think it's a good deal, we're obviously concerned like just about anybody is when they're buying their first home, but we really want to do this, I would get every single thing in writing and treat it as a business or an economic transaction rather than something between two people who happen to know each other and love each other very well. They want to get an appraisal for the house and an independent appraisal, not something that that one party hires and just says, well, this is the right amount for it or the real estate agent's opinion on it. If they do really want the house, they should consider trying to finance it on their own first and going through the bank so that the bank can tell them what kind of terms they could qualify for otherwise. Now, if the couple doesn't want it and says that, it either isn't the right house for us or it's not something that we're looking to do at this time, just say that this isn't right for us right now and thank you very much for a generous offer, but we're not in a position to do it.
So what about the listener's best course of action?
The questioner should probably talk to the son and only the son and only once and give advice and say, look, if you guys go through with this, I'm not really sure you could afford it. And you have to make sure that the terms are understood by both parties going into it and that they're things that you can agree to and you can suffer through the worst case scenario if it should happen. After that, stay out of it. Do not bring it up again to anything because no matter how bad the financial ramifications of the potential transaction might be, they will be nothing compared to decades of acrimony that can be seized upon and brought up again and again between the in-laws and the questioner and the son. And so best thing to do is just butt out.
So you should not say, don't buy that dump from those crooks.
Don't buy the dump from those crooks is probably the exact opposite thing of what you should say. It's better to say nothing at all.
Well, if you have a question for Kevin, be it about your personal finances or maybe some kind of a personal relationship when it comes to your finances, Kevin is ready to answer both kinds. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine along with Kevin McKinley, and this is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Money. Give me some money.
You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, along with certified financial planner Kevin McKinley. If you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Coming up, we will talk about calculating the costs of staying on a job that maybe you don't like very much versus leaving that job. And we'll also talk about what to do when the lights go out, which people in Appleton know all about after a bad storm last Friday. People in Appleton spent much of the whole weekend without power. We will talk about what we can do about that to prepare for something like that coming up a little bit later in the program. Kevin, we have lots of callers lining up, but let me ask you to respond to Kim on Facebook, who, perhaps tongue-in-cheek, writes, "Can Kevin please tell us how to grow a money tree?"
Yes, I would say, actually, we're going to go into that a little bit a little later on for it, too. But now's not the time to be planting. You want to plant your money tree in the spring. So I'm sad to say, Kim, you're going to have a barren winter.
There we go. Let's take some calls. Gary in Deerfield is with us first. Hello, Gary.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead, please.
Yes, I haven't heard for a while Kevin's advice for if you're getting close to retirement, have some money to put away in either Roth IRA, in kind of looking for, in these times, I guess a safe investment. And I think in the past you'd mentioned CDs and kind of a laddering method where you can get a higher rate if they go up. Would that still be a recommendation? Or is there something better to do with the money, you know, like a low-risk fund kind of thing, or that has some opportunity for a little better returns?
Sure. Gary, are you still working right now?
Yes. Okay. Probably about, hopefully, for the next 5 or 6 years.
Okay. Does your employer offer a retirement plan, like a 401k?
Well, it's a nonprofit, and so they have that, but there's no matching funds at all.
That's okay. One of the best things someone in your situation can do with their money, especially if you're a little, if you're comfortable with some fluctuation, most at-work retirement plans do not have certificate of deposit options. And that is, for most people, the safest way to get a little bit of return on their money and still preserve their principal. But there is another option, and that is your at-work retirement plan, or for people who don't have that, a pre-tax IRA. If you put, let's say, $10,000 into a pre-tax retirement plan, most people are going to save at least 20% of that amount on their taxes in the year in which they make that contribution. And several people could save as much as 40% on taxes. So the best way to increase your net worth when you're this close to retirement is not by investing aggressively, it's by saving aggressively. So if you can afford to save more into that pre-tax plan, you'll cut your taxes by about 20 to 40 cents for every single dollar that you get into that plan. Then when you turn around and you stop working and pull the money out, the chances are that that money is going to be taxed for sure at least the same rate and probably a much lower rate because you can manipulate the withdrawals according to your tax and income needs. So if you said, well, what's one thing I should do before retirement? It's try to keep your money as conservatively invested as possible, but bump up your pre-tax contributions because that's a guaranteed way to cut your overall expenses and therefore increase your return.
Okay, one follow-up question on that. By doing it, you know, the Roth IRA is one avenue, but the other avenue you're talking about where you, I guess, a regular IRA or in the 401k, the withdrawal factor, in other words, if you did it, just, is it 5 years? How does that work for...
You mean when can you get the money out?
Yeah, without penalty, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, generally, if it's a pre-tax plan, you can take it out upon retirement after age 59 and a half. You will pay taxes on it, but generally no penalties for it. And you don't have to take anything out until April 1st of the year after you turn 70 and a half. So there's a long time in there between when you put the money in and when you have to take it out. And even at that 70 and a half age range, it's still a very small amount. So that's definitely the easiest way to cut your overall costs and increase your net return.
Good luck to you, Gary. Thanks very much for the call. Chad in the Upper Peninsula is with us now. Hello, Chad.
Hi. I had a question about college savings accounts. Right now, my wife and I both save money for our two young daughters, but right now the money is just in your traditional savings accounts, and I just wanted some information on where the best place was to put that money so that it could gain more interest.
Are you familiar with 529 plans, Chad?
No.
Okay. 529 plans are created, they're basically licensed by each state. Almost every state has one. And then they generally farm out the money management responsibilities to a mutual fund company or a bank. And they have an array of investment options that are usually like your at-work retirement plan options, where there's, say, 10 to 15 fund choices from which to choose. How old are your children, Chad?
I got one that's 6 and one that's 18 months.
18 months, great. Most of these college savings plans, and the best place to go to get information on them is at savingforcollege.com. Savingforcollege.com runs down all different states' plans and tries to judge which ones are the best, talks about expenses and investment options, but you can find out which one is most appropriate for you there. But when you're putting money into a particular fund, if you don't know when to where to invest, one thing many of these plans offer is age-based investment options, meaning that you can open up two accounts, one for the six-year-old and one for that 18-month-old that we hear in the background. and then it starts out with a fairly aggressive mix, meaning more stocks and less bonds and cash. And as the child's matriculation date comes, if you will, they get closer to turning 18, generally the portfolios become more conservative as the high school graduation draws near. Now, that doesn't mean that they can't go down in value. They can, but that's a good way to kind of put it on autopilot and have the investing done for you rather than having to decide on a regular basis how it's done.
So, Chad, did your baby have a follow-up to that?
Yeah, I had a question with that. So, in the long run, then, is it safe if I keep putting money in there by the time they're start college, would that money be, if something happened like an economic downturn, would that money be almost gone, or would it be still enough for them to pay a semester or two in tuition?
Neither. it won't be almost gone, it's highly unlikely that the money will just disappear. But it's also hard to know exactly. One of the problems, of course, with saving for college is the tuition costs jump up on an average of about 5 to 6% per year. Well, there are no investments out there that offer a guaranteed 5 to 6% per year. So you do have to take some risk if you do want to try to meet that. You can. There are usually some safer options like CDs, but those only pay 2 to 3% per year. So the good news about a certificate of deposit is the money's likely to be there. The bad news is it probably won't rise with the level of inflation that college costs are rising. So you might want to do like a 50-50 strategy where if you're concerned about the loss, you might want to put half the money in safe investments like CDs and keep rolling them over, and then the other half in age-based portfolios that will have some fluctuation but might do a better job of keeping pace with the rise in college costs over the long term.
And good luck to you, Chad, and your children. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, Jane... the kid listening in there actually lowered our demographic by about 8 years,
right,
so it really
right.
helped out.
Thanks, Chad. James in Delafield is with us now. Hello, James.
Hello.
Yes. Do you have a question for Kevin?
Yeah. My question was based on cash value, universal life insurance. Just a little background on myself. I'm fully funding my 401k, put it in 10%. We have almost a year's worth of emergency cash. Putting in, I have a Roth IRA, a regular IRA, and we're putting in money into a 529 plan for both my kids. So we're trying to find out, you know, we had a couple bits of extra money. We were putting it in the cash value. Just wondering, is that still a good idea? You know, we just feel like, I don't know if that was a good idea or not, now looking back at it. So I'm just kind of wanting to find out what he thinks about it.
He thinks that cash value life insurance has its place. It's probably not as widely needed as it is used. Typically, it's sold as saying, hey, you not only get life insurance, but you get an investment component or you get a savings account so that you can build up cash value in this and get the life insurance. And even in the times of high rates of return, that typically has been kind of an iffy proposition. Sometimes it's worked out really well for people. In your situation, James, from what you said, it sounds like you'd probably be better off using term life insurance. Not only do you get way more life insurance for way less money, but you can use the other money to invest more into those college savings plans or Roth IRAs or your at-work retirement plan and cut your taxes. Cash value or permanent life insurance is better for people who are, you know, business owners and concerned about a liquidity problem if they should pass away, and people who have concerns about an estate tax issue if they should pass away. They buy a cash value policy, a permanent one, so that the money's going to be there whenever to pay off any taxes or provide liquidity for their business. So for most young families, it's usually better off to use term life insurance that lasts until the kids are hopefully on their own, which used to be 21 or 22. These days it's 42.
Or 26. So did he answer your question, James?
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, thanks very much for the call. We'll take more calls in just a moment, 1-800-642-1234. If you have a question about Money Matters for Kevin, you can also email us on yourmoney@WPR.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. It's time now for the Smart Assets segment of the show. Workers who are sick and tired of working often dream of doing something else or nothing else. And it is possible to make that dream come true, but Kevin, you say it will require some sacrifice and some courage.
Yeah, I can think of no better time or date than the Tuesday morning after Labor Day as people are going to work, back to work, to think about how much longer do we have to do this. And I really do recommend that people pursue this thought, even if they are happy with the jobs. The only time that I really wince is when people say, hey, I've got this really great job. I like it. I make good money at it. But I've always wanted to open my own cupcake stand. And I have a partner and three children to support and a mortgage. But I think the cupcake stand is really going to make me happy. That's when I tend to be a little bit concerned about things. But really, it's a good idea to, at any stage in your life, to calculate the cost of staying on your job versus the cost of leaving. And even if you're happy with it, you might not always be happy with it, or the decision might not always be yours. Most people know now that our job security is more tenuous than it's been in many years. So it's a good idea to do it now versus later. And even running a fire drill of your situation, say, okay, what if I were to get to work today and find out that my job was no longer there, can help ease stress. There was a University of Michigan study released a couple weeks ago that said that people who are worried about losing their job undergo more stress than people who actually lose their job.
They measure
their stress, and they said that the fretting over losing the job is more stressful than actually losing the job. So you run a fire drill and say, what if I were to lose my job today? What would happen? And you might find out that even in this situation, you say, oh gosh, this actually is a good deal, and staying is easier and more easy to tolerate.
Well, I can imagine radio knobs being turned up right now. What is the first step to deciding whether we can stay in a job or should leave a current job?
It's figuring out how you're going to survive if you lose your job or leave your job. And that involves first adding up your monthly expenses, your typical base monthly cost, and saying, okay, this is what it costs for us to get by. Go through that and find out what can be cut and say, you know what, we're spending too much on this or that. And then figure out what the transition cost would be if you were to leave your current job and have to start either a new one or a new career, either how much time you're going to be out of work. We mentioned last week that the average worker who is unemployed has been unemployed for 40 weeks. So that's 10 months that people might, on average, be out of work before they get a new job. So you should have that much, at least, in expenses set aside for it. And then also, if you should lose your income, how can you replace it if lost? Can it come out of savings? Can you get a part-time job? Can you tap your home equity without having to go back and get a new mortgage? And then once you figure that out and say, you know what, we're going to be down about $2,000 a month, let's say, once I leave, is it going to be worth it? If it is, great. If not, you might want to think about staying.
Well, after you figure out covering the cost of living, what is the biggest obstacle to leaving a job?
it's very sad that this is such a major factor in millions and millions of Americans' families' decisions of when they work, how they work, and where they work, but it's health insurance. Mm-hmm. And if you're fortunate enough to have a spouse or a partner who can obtain health insurance while you pursue a different path in life, that's great. But there are several part-time employers who do offer health insurance benefits to their employees. Many of them are in retail, which isn't the greatest job in the world, but many people are very glad to have those jobs because they do have some form of group health insurance. It is possible to buy health insurance on your own, and sometimes people are pleasantly surprised that it's less expensive than what they expected. And as a last resort, and only in an emergency, you can go without and just plan on paying cash for whatever medical services you need beyond catastrophic care. One of the good and the bad things about this is with the recent changes in healthcare legislation, some people may have more opportunity to purchase health insurance on their own, which would free them from working for an employer they didn't care to work for. But that legislation is obviously tenuous and up in the air, so we don't quite know what that future will hold for the next couple of years.
Okay, let's say someone has resolved these issues, has the health insurance, can cover the cost of living. What financial steps should be taken next?
Well, it's a surprising but a common theme for the On Your Money show. It's to extend your mortgage out. Many people say, well, gosh, if I leave my job, I don't want to have a mortgage payment, so I'm just going to use all my savings and I'm going to pay off the mortgage. That is the exact wrong thing to do in this situation. What you want to do is before you leave your job is go back to the bank, get a new 30-year fixed rate mortgage for as much as the lender will allow, and then park that savings aside to not only tide you over in the event you don't find your job, but to cover any unplanned expenses for it. Stop contributing to your retirement plans. This change requires that you delay your retirement usually if you are going to move to a different job or career. Do not pay off any debt and invest very conservatively because you don't want any big swoon in the market to erode your savings that you've set aside in case there's an emergency. You should assume very low income. Many people make the mistake, especially when they're starting a business, if they haven't done it before, of assuming that costs are going to be too low and earnings are going to be too high and they're unpleasantly surprised. So be very pessimistic on what your future earnings and expenses will be, and then have a backup plan. Assume that this change is not going to work and already have something in mind for, say, okay, I'm going to give this a year or 2 years, and if it doesn't work, I'm going to either go back to what I used to do or I'm going to go get another job or just retire completely.
Well, what if you go through this exercise and discover or decide that you really can't leave your job, but you really, really want to quit?
It's still a valuable experience, partially because you get a better sense of your priorities and where things are at. You might appreciate the job and say, oh my gosh, if I didn't have this job, I would be completely broke. I have no other usable skills. I would be out of luck. My family would starve and I wouldn't have any health mm-hmm. insurance. And it tends to then allow you to look at your job and the stresses involved in a different light. If you get in that situation and say, gosh, I have to stay here, I'm stuck with it, still cut your expenses and start maximizing your retirement account, because it means that your actual day of financial independence is going to be coming much sooner than what it would otherwise be. And that alone can be not only liberating, but it can help you endure your job. Once you get to a point on your job where you know that, say, hey, I can walk away from here at any moment, it means that you're there only because you want to be, not because you have to be. And it's an analogy I use for people when I'm talking with them. It's no different to say if you could lie down on the floor right now with a pillow in the dark and take a nice little nap, it would be one of the best parts of your day. If someone came along and started building a coffin around you, you'd start struggling to get out of that position as soon as you could. And so because you have the control and the will to be able to leave your job whenever you can, it makes it much more easy to stay in that position and stay in that job for as long as you can stand it.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, is with us just about every Tuesday at this time with information and advice on your money. And we have one open line for you at 1-800-642-1234 or email us on yourmoney@wpr.org. Doug in Middleton is with us now. Hello, Doug.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm trying to refinance. I own a 5-acre farmette just west of Middleton, and we were trying to refinance. We're unable to get a fixed rate mortgage because we have farm income, and our farm income consists of a pumpkin patch that I do with my daughter each year, and we save the money toward her college. So it's not like our only income.
Yeah.
So anyway, we've been to 3 banks and 2 credit unions, and we can't get a fixed rate mortgage.
Because of the pumpkin money.
Yeah, because we have a Schedule F in our tax return.
That doesn't sound fair either, Kevin.
Oh, it doesn't sound fair either, but it's a good illustration for people. Hey, growing pumpkins is not all glitz and glamour.
Okay, yeah, right.
People, there's some downside to it. It's not just celebrities and jets and Hollywood and the red carpet, all right?
Exactly.
There's some drawbacks. Doug, without going too much into detail, would it be possible at all to say, hey, to get a fixed rate mortgage, we have to give up the pumpkin patch? Is it worth it to you to do that or not?
Well, we were told that if we gave it up, we could get a fixed rate mortgage, but we would have to give it up for 2 years before we could be considered for a fixed rate mortgage.
Okay.
Yes, we could do that, but then we also risk having our land rezoned, whereas right now it's zoned agricultural.
Mm-hmm. So your property taxes would be a little higher, right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, here's what I would recommend. I would assume when you say you can't get a fixed rate mortgage that you can get an adjustable rate mortgage, correct?
That's right.
Okay. And you can probably get an adjustable rate mortgage that is fixed for probably 5 to 7 years, maybe?
Yeah, I believe so.
Okay, and the rate at which it's fixed is probably actually even lower than the very low rate offered on 30-year mortgages right now as well, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, that's what I would do. I would take them up on their very generous offer to finance not only your farmette, but the pumpkin patch as well. Take it out for as much as possible at the adjustable rate, which is, again, fixed for as long as possible, 7 years. You know, I think the average life of a mortgage right now is somewhere around 3 or 4 years, partially because people have moved a lot, partially because of refinancing. But chances are that whatever happens in your life 7 or 8 years from now, not only will this be a very good rate during that time, but even when it can go up, it may not go up if interest rates are still very low. And even if it does go up, it can probably go up only incrementally for maybe 2 percentage points per year. For instance, if you start out at 4%, the most it can go up is to 6% in a year and then 8%. And after that 7 or 8 year time frame, Doug, a good portion of that principal will be retired. So the interest cost will probably still be lower at that point, if it does go up, even if you do go with just an ARM versus the fixed rate. So I definitely take them up on that. And then I'd start to rethink the cost and benefit of the pumpkin patch and say, hey, could we do away with this for a couple years and then get the proper documentation so that we can get a fixed rate if it becomes available, and then also start it back up again if you want to and keep your zoning.
By the way, Kevin, our crafty, smarty pants producer, Rob Ferret, who, by the way, has been standing up and stretching and such during the whole program, wonders if the pumpkin patch could be somehow transferred into the daughter's name, and might that help?
That's an interesting thing. How old is your daughter, Doug?
16.
Okay, I'm sure.
Yeah.
There's a danger in giving teenagers too much, and if you spoil her by making her a scion, if you will, of a pumpkin growing empire, I wouldn't want her friends to think she was thinking she was better than everybody else. And
right.
So much in the same way you don't want to give her a car or convertible for her 16th birthday, the pumpkin patch could be even more damaging.
It's just kind of absurd that, here's something that generates, about $3,000 a year that's saved for her college education, and that keeps us from refinancing. Does this mean that all farmers are unable to get a fixed rate mortgage?
Generally, yes, because they treat it as a business, and that's sometimes why you see people splitting up their primary residence from the actual farm business as well. It's very difficult for business owners to get a 30-year fixed-rate loan, and because the dirt is the business in many cases, it's usually included on the negative side. Now, this is 4 or 5 years ago. You could have a heartbeat and get a 30-year fixed-rate loan. These are obviously different times.
Doug, thanks very much for the call, and good luck to you and your daughter and your pumpkins, too. We have time for a few more calls, and we are going to talk about whether you are prepared for a disaster and what you can do when the power goes out in just a moment. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley, and this is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
When you're in the dark and you want to see, you need a
electricity, electricity.
Flip that switch.
You're listening to On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine along with Kevin McKinley. And in the last few weeks, millions of Americans and thousands of Wisconsin residents have found out how bad things can get when they have no electricity. Kevin, I know a number of friends and family in Appleton who went not just a couple of hours without power, but for several days. It was terrible.
And you always find out at that point just how reliant we are upon electricity. Mm-hmm. And Tropical Storm Irene, of course, put about 5 million Americans without power for hours or days. And then in Wisconsin, about 40,000 people, We Energy said, lost power at some point during that storm. So you always find out when it's too late and there's nothing you can do about it. So it's a good idea to start thinking now about what you would do if the power were to go out. And today we'll talk about several different kinds of generators and power supplies that you can buy and put together on your own.
Is this an expensive proposition?
The most useful ones are, these are ones that are giant generators, and it's usually just a matter of flipping a switch, and all of a sudden your entire home can draw power from it to a great degree. But they can cost anywhere from $5,000 to $15,000 to install, and there's a lot of work to it because, again, it's just a power source, no different than the utility company for it. There is a lot of ongoing maintenance and testing. You still need fuel usually to run these, and unless you live in an isolated area or you have severe health issues where you might have you need to keep insulin ready, or you have some type of oxygen machine, it's probably not necessary for most people.
What about the gas-powered ones?
Those are the ones that you always use. You know, it's a standard B-roll for news stories of when a hurricane is coming. These people are always running out of Menards and Home Depot or wherever with these generators, and the prices have gone up a lot, and they're all out, and everybody's calling around to find them. They cost about $500 to $1,000 or so. They're very loud. You can usually use them to power one big appliance like a refrigerator or in a freezer, or several small ones. But again, these are generally small engine devices, and so it's no different than maintaining a lawnmower. You can't just let it sit there for 4 years, and then when you need it, fire it up. It usually doesn't work that well, and so you do have to maintain it and drain the oil and the fuel, et cetera, if you're not going to need it. And so that can also be more expensive as well.
Is there a more convenient solution?
Yeah, this is what I would recommend for people. Say, you know what, I'm not worried about Armageddon, but I do want to keep my cell phone and my coffee maker working whenever I possibly can. Get one of those power inverters that plugs into a car's, used to be called a cigarette lighter, but since, you know, hardly anybody smokes in their car anymore, now that's just like the glove box. They call it the alternate power supply. But you can take these anywhere. You can use them at any time, and all you have to do is just turn the car's engine on. It doesn't drain very much fuel just to leave the car idling for a while. Plug it in. Obviously, you want to pop the garage door open, or you'll sleep very well that night and for much longer. But run it in a well-ventilated area. And you might want to buy two or three. They usually cost anywhere from $10 to $70 or so, depending on the size and sturdiness and stability of the inverter. Amazon.com has a ton of these kind of things for sale. And they also have a really great informational page on generators in general. And we'll put a link up to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Time now for another call or two for Kevin during this edition of On Your Money. And Joan in Coloma is with us next. Hello, Joan.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead, please.
My son is going back to grad school and has, of course, the undergrad student loans. And I wondered if there was another vehicle to put those student loans in that he could pay off, you know, a low payment monthly instead of accrue this $3,000 plus a year interest, or even putting it on a student credit card.
You're saying that you want to know if there's another loan that he can use then to pay off the student loans and not have to pay as much in interest.
Yeah.
Do you happen to know, Joan, what the interest rate is that he's
it's
under right now?
8.5.
Okay. Has he consolidated?
Which is a typical student loan.
Mm-hmm. Has he tried to consolidate those loans yet?
No.
Okay. That's one thing I would recommend because he can typically bring it down to a lower interest rate. I assume he's not a homeowner, right?
No.
Okay. He can go talk with a lender at a bank or credit union and see if there are any other solutions out there, especially the larger ones do have some student loan help that they can offer those people. But it is just one cost that that he is going to have to further and continue his education. Generally, it's very difficult to get out from under these things once you take them. Consolidation can do it, but there are also some drawbacks to doing that as well. So I would actually have him go back to either his current or his past financial aid office, and typically they'll offer some counseling to him as to what his options are with those specific loans, because every loan has its own different permutations and what you can and can't do with it for consolidation. Go back to the school's financial aid office to see what they can tell him to do, and hopefully you can get that interest rate down a little bit.
Okay.
All right. Thanks very much, Joan, for the call. Next is Carl in Eau Claire. Hello, Carl.
Hello.
Yes, what's your question for Kevin?
I have, or my wife and I have, various things. We're nearing retirement. We have 403B, we have Roth IRA, regular IRA, and I was told that there could be some advantage to moving, even now that we're near retirement, moving some money out of regular IRAs into Roth IRAs because of tax rates and such, and I was wondering if that makes sense, or just to leave some in each.
Yeah, it does make sense, but you're still working now, right, Carl?
I am not. My wife is.
Your wife is. Okay. The key to moving IRAs or converting IRAs and 401ks to Roth IRAs is really the rate at which it will be taxed versus if you don't move it at all. And for most married couples, the figure that you're looking for is line 43 on your 1040, and that tells you what tax rate you would be in if you were to convert the IRAs. Generally, the rule of thumb is that you should retire first, then convert IRAs to Roth IRAs to the extent you can stay under that 15% federal tax bracket ceiling, and then initiate your Social Security. And the way you'll end up then is in tax-free accounts for the Roth IRA, Social Security as your base income, which is generally tax-free or taxed at a lower rate than ordinary income, and then maybe a little bit left in IRAs that can be pulled out as needed as long as you are going to stay under that lowest bracket. But I wouldn't make the conversion until your wife actually retired, and if you have money to survive on without taking Social Security, I would make the conversions before you initiate Social Security for the two of you.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks very much. Almost out of time, but let me ask Neil in Woodbine's question. He wants to know your thoughts on federal I-bonds.
Series I savings bonds, yeah, they pay 4.6% right now on an annualized basis. That's exempt from state taxes, not federal taxes. They're great. There are some limits to them, but the 4.6% is only good through November 1st, so you're only going to get a couple months of that, and then it will reset. Again, it might be the same rate, might be higher, but it probably will be lower. They're very safe. They're very secure. You can only buy $10,000 per person per year, but you can go to treasurydirect.gov to get more information on those, and again, we'll have that link up at onyourmoney.com later on today.
All right, sounds good. What is the website of the week, Kevin?
Well, we've talked about the key to financial independence is knowing what you spend every single month, and that's difficult for many people to do who are too busy to track it. So thebirdie.com, B-I-R-D-Y, thebirdie.com is kind of a neat little twist on this because it sends you an email every day and says, how much did you spend today in these different categories? All you have to do is answer the information, and then it keeps track of it for you and reports back not only where it's going, but some ways that you might be able to cut that. Thebirdie.com, it's free, and we'll have the link up at onyourmoney.com later on.
Sounds great. Four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. He will be back with us next week for another edition of On Your Money. Tomorrow at this time, taking our chaotic lives and slowing them down and appreciating things. I'll be talking with the author of the book Slow Love, who will have advice on how we can slow down and appreciate life. Tomorrow morning between 8 and 9. Thanks to Rob Ferret and to Bill Martins for producing this hour. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.